Thank you. I'm John. I'm an addict and alcoholic. I got a somebody, of course, tries to call me right during this. I got a call from +352 country code this afternoon, and I thought, hey, is this Lithuania? Is this like one of those sales people or weird things? I don't recognize three digit country codes or whatever. And yeah, it was and I even forgot the guy's name, but I guess we had before on Zoom or whatever, and he had asked me before if I'd speak, and then he said, well, somebody has a sore throat, will you speak today? So I'm sorry for you're getting me. So if you were looking for the lady with the other lady, well, she has a sore throat. So yeah, I just passed a milestone in sobriety this past week. My sobriety date is October the 5th of 1986, and that means 35 years. And that was kind of like, I mean, that's a whole lifetime. And there's an AA saying about that. I mean, how do you get to be an old timer in AA? You don't drink and you don't die. And so I haven't drunk, and that's amazing. Just about more about me. I live in Paris. I've lived in France now in Paris for 30 years. And I've lived in many places, but I grew up in Amarillo, Texas, which I don't know if any of you have been to Texas or if you've been to the panhandle of Texas, but I always hated it. I always hated it. I mean, I didn't, I, not that I always hated it. As soon as I got out of there, then I always hated it. But growing up as a kid there, it was, I remember being very bored as a child, and I remember I remember the exciting things in childhood were when we got air conditioning because then I could just like stay in the house and read and didn't have to go out in the fucking heat and or watch TV. And the other thing was, yeah, we got cable TV, and then we got like these old TV shows and old movies. And yeah, I loved to read and I loved watching TV. And when I but I wanted I guess the first thing was, and there's some Californians here, my parents, we went on a driving trip, a driving vacation to California. And I was like, wow, this is like kind of like way better. I don't know. It's like really interesting. And there's Disneyland and there's Universal Studios. And so there was that. And then I went on a when I was a kid, I also went with a church choir. I went on a summer trip to Canada. And believe me, if you grew up in Amarillo, Texas, Canada, I mean, that sounded like so exotic. Oh my God, Canada, another country, but I had, this has nothing really to do with alcoholism. I had a pretty happy childhood. My parents loved me. I was not abused as a child. I cannot at all blame my parents for becoming a drug addict and an alcoholic at all. Except I think there is a genetic connection because both of my grandfathers were alcoholics. One of my uncles was an alcoholic. One of my cousins was an addicted gambler. And I'm trying to think, yeah, another one of my cousins was an alcoholic, and I didn't have that many cousins to begin with. But it's like, okay, so if there's somebody that I need to blame, then I'll just blame genetics, right? Because I think there's a big part of genetics in alcoholism. And maybe other people think differently. I don't know. Is it disease? I don't know. But I know that, that definitely, I easily became a drug addict and alcoholic. And, I was so happy when I graduated from high school. I went to Austin, which I is still a place in America I love. It's a really cool town. And, going there and going to university was like, wow. And I think the first weekend that I was in Austin, I started smoking pot, and I smoked pot also as much as I could get it. I loved pot. I was a complete pothead. And, you know, the drinking was already, I didn't really start until I was 18. But when I went away to college, you know, there were keg parties and there was just stuff that, you know, I mean, there were a lot of opportunities to get drunk and high, and I did it as much as possible. And if I look back on that period of my life and examine it really closely, I can see that alcohol and drugs were a problem from the very beginning, really from the very beginning. I tended to drink more than most people, you know, and I had issues I got a DUI when I was like 21 or 20. I mean, I you know, the alcohol kind of made me just kind of crazy. And, you know, I rarely just had just a little bit, you know, so it was, even though, you know, I mean, I graduated with high honors in college. I was still able to do a lot of things. I think, you know, when I was young, I was, even though I got into some trouble, it was pretty well overlooked. You know, it was the late 70s, early 80s. People were like, you know, okay, DUI. Well, you know, you got a PEF fine. It was not that big a deal. And my parents were pissed off. Not that big a deal, you know. But things got, you know, probably a little bit worse. I went away for a year to Brazil. I studied in Brazil for a year, and there, there I also came out. I'm gay, and being in Rio de Janeiro in that time, you know, it was a wild and fun, reckless place, and it was very hot sexually, and Brazilians are very hot. And so I had a fabulous time though. And, I came back, I went to grad school. In grad school and also in South America, I was doing quite a bit of cocaine, also whenever I could get it or afford it. It just sped things up, which is what cocaine does. And so I kind of struggled in grad school, you know, because I was partying all the time, I guess. And, but I got out, I got a job with a major American company. I was a Latin American specialist. And so they sent me to Taiwan. That's my first expat position. And it was a dream job. I had a house and a car and a gardener and a swimming pool. And, you know, I was like 25 years old, probably. And, you know, it was like almost I had it all. But in Taiwan in those days, you could go to the pharmacy and get basically whatever you wanted. And I did. And I started taking speed over the counter. I mean, that I could get over the counter. It was regular. I don't know what it was, but it was definitely strong. And I went to Hong Kong for kind of a weekend and went to some chic disco and grabbed some Chinese Hong Kong movie star's ass in the bar who wasn't gay, and he like kung fu'd me around the discotheque, and that was one terrible thing that happened. And, you know, I came back and we did mushrooms as well, and I started losing touch with reality, right? I was not sleeping. And I started losing touch with reality. And I had what they called, what the psychiatrist said, I called an acute paranoid episode, which, you know, I thought that the Chinese people were out to get me. And if you live in Taiwan, well, you know, that's pretty, you know, that's everybody except for, you know, so I was just nuts. And I went into the office, said strange things and made like cryptic phone calls to my parents and people I knew. And so they sent me back fairly quickly to the US, and they sent me to a psychiatrist who was associated with the company that I was working for. And after a few sessions with him, he told me, he said, you know, I can save your job for you, but if in order for me to do that, then you have to agree to go to alcoholism and drug addiction to an inpatient treatment facility. And they had one picked out in Minnesota and stuff, a famous place of treatment in those days. And I was like, you know, fuck you, man. I don't need this job. I can get another job. Because I really thought, you know, okay, I did fuck this up, but you know, there's no way I'm going to do that. And I said, you know, I can get another job. I don't need this job. And, you know, I was right. I did get another job. I did not go to treatment. A friend of mine's dad, president of a company in Holland, and they needed somebody for Latin America. So I got a job as a sales rep in Latin America. And, you know, even before I got went over there to take the job, we were going to go to a David Bowie concert. And the night before, I went out to the gay bars in Hamburg, and I don't know how, but you know, I don't remember, but I broke my ankle. So I was, you know, instead of going to hear David Bowie, I listened to him high on pills and stuff in you know, the university Krankenhaus in Hamburg. But I got the job, and I kept that job for a year. And being in Latin America again, I lived in the Caribbean and the Dutch island of Curaçao, and I was really becoming miserable because they had a very pure form of cocaine that we would smoke called bazuco or bazooka, I don't remember. And that stuff kind of really made me worse if I could have gotten worse, you know? So, again, I had to come back because they didn't renew my working contract in the end. I mean, they tried to help me, but actually I got to Amsterdam, which there you are, another place, another big drug capital of the 80s. And I got there and there I went on like probably my first like alcohol bender, alcohol and hash, you know, and whatever else I could get. And so there, you know, it was funny because I was just, again, kind of losing touch with reality, and I didn't know what to do, and you know, I was just drinking all the time. And I finally told those friends of mine, I said, oh, my father has died, I have to go back to, you know, to America. My father hadn't died. I don't know why I made up that story, but you know, so I went back and moved in with my mom and stepfather and back in Amarillo, and I was so miserable. My parents, after, you know, all these stories and shit, they were like, I think my mom started seeing a counselor, you know. I feel so sorry, I think, when I think about her life, because her father was an alcoholic. And I remember her telling stories about him. And then, you know, ended up her son also being an alcoholic. But anyway, she had gotten some kind of help or counseling or whatever. And so I decided at one point to go visit a friend of mine in New Mexico who had a ranch out there. And I flipped a car. It was not even the first time I flipped a car, but I rolled this car. So when I got back from that little latest disaster, my mom said, you are going to Alcoholics Anonymous and you are going to go every single day if you want to stay in this house. And I really didn't have a lot of choice. And I remember that first AA meeting and I absolutely detested it. I mean, it was super smoke filled, that I remember. Of course, I smoked as well, so I don't guess that would have, you know, that would have been an uncomfortable thing. But I just, the whole thing with those 12 steps written on the wall and the thing about God, and and they were pretty nice though. And but I mean, I would never have gone back for of my own accord, but I did go that whole time that I was living there practically every day. And I did manage to stop, I guess, for that time. But I didn't believe what they were saying, because I really, you know, had this idea that, you know, alcoholics are people who live under bridges, and, you know, I have a master's degree, I'm really smart, I speak a lot of languages, you know, I'm too smart to be an alcoholic. I think I thought that. And, you know, of course, I realized today that alcoholism has nothing to do with, first of all, I'm probably not that smart. There are a lot of people smarter than me. And that, you know, I can be as smart as I want to be, but I cannot outsmart alcoholism. So after that, well, I did get a job, and I was able to move away from, Amarillo. And I mean, it was, I was glad to get this job, and but I immediately started drinking again. Of course, I didn't go to AA. When I had several bad trips again, you know, I don't know what it was, but I guess something that they said in those meetings must have stuck with me. So I decided of my own volition to go back to AA. And I remember one of the first meetings, I mean, I didn't really know about it, but I already knew that I disliked the whole part of it that was kind of like very churchy. It was super churchy. And I remember one of the meetings I went to, it was at a Baptist church, and I had a bad experiences with Baptist churches before it. And I remember I drove up to this Baptist church, and there were all these people in the parking lot with their books, their big books in their hand. And I left, and you know, I just said, well, maybe if there's one at a different church, at an Episcopal church or something else, it will be better. But, and I ended up going to a meeting that was at a hospital, and it was people who were in inpatient treatment, and I met at one of those meetings, I met my first friend in AA, and his name was Richard, and he was like really cool. I mean, he was super good looking. He was rich. He'd been to the Betty Ford Center, which I was extremely impressed with. This was his second treatment, right? And he was just a neat guy and funny, and you know, so I kept going to AA in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I even got a sponsor, and you know, who was nice. He was a nice man, and he was very kind to me. And I think, you know, he was one of those like AA speaker types, and he was like a radio personality, but he was kind. But I remember he would say, my name's David and I'm an alcoholic and I'm sober. I'm sober thanks to the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, my higher power and you people, you know. It's just like that same, you know, that. So, and I think about that guy, cause he did help me in person, and I still have somewhere, like he wrote me these typewritten letters, and I still have saved those letters that he wrote to me. But what ended up happening was, after 1 year, that company, they sent me to Europe, and so I moved to Germany, and my first best friend in AA, Richard, I guess I'd lived in Germany. It was the first year I lived in Germany. He had a house he and his lover had a house in Key West. And so I flew from Germany down to Key West, you know, to stay with them for like a week or something. And Richard picked me up at the airport, and he was just dead drunk, you know? And I was like, wow, you know, because I had kind of signed on to AA, and my life had gotten better. And, you know, it was, I didn't really want to go back to drinking, you know. It definitely, you know, there was no way I wanted to, even then, you know. And so that was a shock, you know, that he was drunk. And you know, a couple, it wasn't that much longer later, I don't remember now because this was all such a long time ago, but you know, he kept drinking and he died. And I went to his funeral and it was like, wow, that was super sad. And that sponsor of mine, he killed himself. And that was not also that much longer after he killed himself. And because I also discovered that he was getting high, he smoked a lot of pot. So it was like, wow. I was like, you know, there, of course, they always said, you know, it's a progressive illness and, you know, and can be fatal and all this stuff. And at some point, you know, I took AA seriously, I guess. So taking it seriously, on the other hand, I never really worked like all the steps. Maybe I did it like right at the first, but you know, that writing that stuff down, maybe that was helpful. I don't remember. But in AA English speaking, I went to German meetings. The people were super nice. I had, you know, I made friends with the people, and they were not really very religious-y. They were just like fun people to hang around with. And after living in Germany for 4 years, I moved to Paris in 91, right? So I think it makes 30 years here. And Paris, I was exciting. There were movie stars here, you know, everybody goes. So they speaking at least of that in the 90s. You know, these famous people were coming and they've written about it. So, you know, going to a meeting and like having Elton John sit down, I was like, whoa, wow, this is like really, this is neat. You know, so I really liked Paris AA in the beginning, and I, you know, frequented pretty much all the meetings. But I guess at some point, probably after about 4 or 5 years, I mean, I was never at all a strong believer. I probably mouthed the higher power. In fact, I'm sure I mouthed the higher power stuff at first, but I don't think I ever really believed in it. And I traveled frequently, and I traveled frequently also to, because the headquarters of the company I'm working for were in suburban New York City. So I went to meetings in New York City, and I went to my first agnostics meeting. And I was like, wow, you know, because the people were just like, we don't believe any of this crap. They were very out. They were very just like not into AA dogma, but they were still sober. And I really, really liked that. So I think probably about 20 years ago, we started an agnostic meeting in Paris. And that meeting is still going on today. In fact, we had a first face-to-face meeting yesterday. And you know, I tried to go to the Zoom meeting, but I got into arguments with people there and it was not good. So Zoom has changed everything, by the way, in AA, and it's been great. So anyway, we started this agnostics meeting, and then it was like, ooh, you know, we took the steps and took the word God out, you know, and that was like super revolutionary. But, and I was afraid they wouldn't let us do that, like with the inner group or something, but nobody really cared. And so we started that meeting. And then later on, we started Free Thinkers meeting. We started an English one, and we started a bilingual one. And so if there is a, there's a saying, you know, that if you have a resentment about a meeting, take your coffee pot and your resentment and start another meeting. And that's also what's happened in the Zoom meetings. And it's been really, really great for the secular AA movement. But because there are a lot of us who are not believers, there are a lot of us who are, you know, hate AA dogma and hate just, you know, that whole part about that one has to swallow in traditional AA to a greater or lesser degree, or at least, you know, pay somehow homage to it by not speaking out against it, you know, that for me, I'm just like really over that. So we had that meeting, and then I guess the next really breakthrough in my sobriety was a woman called Dorothy in 2014 organized a secular AA convention in Santa Monica. So here we have another California thing. And I went to that. I don't know how she got my number or whatever. Who remembers these things? But, you know, I went and probably because I was, you know, from Paris and they wanted to, you know, make it sound sophisticated or whatever. They were like, you know, got old Texas John to come and they had me speak and everything. And I, you know, and it was really great. And most of it, it was great to encounter the people. I mean, one of the things that I really objected to at that thing was they had asked this guy, who was an Episcopal priest, to be the keynote speaker. And I thought, well, you know, it's supposed to be like, and they called it We Agnostics Convention, right? And those of you who've read that chapter, you know, it's like not real helpful to those of us who are non-believers. But the people were super cool. And there, you know, I met other atheists and other people who just didn't believe. And in my talk, I got up and said in that, you know, it's like, We Agnostics Convention. I was like, well, what about We Agnostics and Atheists? What about the atheists? Are you leaving us out? Because, you know, the whole thing now. And even there was like, let's be inclusive and everything. And so they changed the name at the next convention, which we got to do in Austin. And that was like right. And they changed the name to We Agnostics, Atheists, and Freethinkers. They called it WAFT, in the end, We Agnostic Atheists and Freethinkers. And the next convention was in Austin. I went to that too, and I was active. I was actually on the board of that. We argued a lot because some of the people wanted it. You know, they wanted to have, this was the thing. Some of the people at that convention, they wanted to have the publisher or the editor. They wanted to have the editor of The Grapevine as the keynote speaker. And if you've ever read that Grapevine, I mean, it's just a lot of religious malarkey. So we had just really knock out fights over that, and we managed in the end to not have that woman be the keynote speaker. That she did speak at something else, but you know, some people were furious that we didn't do that, you know, because a lot of people really like that connection to traditional AA. For me, I've severed it. You know, I do not go to regular AA meetings anymore. I tried for years and years to go. But the more transparent or the more out that I was about it, you know, I just all the time, I just felt like, you know, I was being really aggressive. So you can't go to a third step meeting of regular AA and say, I'm an atheist and I don't believe in this shit and have positive feedback. It's just, it's too harsh. It's just too much for me. And I couldn't, you know, I just couldn't go anymore. Very rarely I go. The last traditional meeting I went to was in not this latest summer, but the one before. I was on a business trip and I was in Detroit. And I don't know, I just really felt like I needed a meeting. And so I went, and it was in downtown Detroit, and that people were actually really, really nice, and it wasn't overly, it wasn't one of those, it was just like a discussion meeting or something. So it wasn't it wasn't bad at all. Of course they had a prayer at the end. And, you know, I don't really like saying, I just don't like A to be churchy. I don't see why it has to be churchy and why we have to follow the dogma. So yeah, where am I in this story? The conventions, the Austin convention, and then the last convention was in Toronto, and I was also active in participating in that. It was slightly less contentious, but it was still contentious because they asked the people from the Grapevine to come and set up a booth, you know, and a lot of us, we just don't go for that, you know, and especially there's a guy called John H. From Washington, and he's even maybe more outspoken than I am. But you know, he took him to task for that. And So there was some contentiousness at that. But then the whole pandemic happened. And, you know, like I mentioned, for me, before the pandemic, I had stopped going to regular AA meetings. And we had started even before the Toronto convention, and the Toronto convention was in 2018, I think. Even before that, I had, I'd stopped going to regular meetings, but we had a Zoom meeting, and it was called Secular Sunday. And, I led that meeting up until a few months ago. It started out as like maybe 6 or 8 people. And then the pandemic hit, and at the high point, there were 80 people in that meeting. And we read out of the Joe C. book, which I think you've had Joe C. speak here. We just read the meditation, and then, you know, everybody shared. And just because I kind of thought that book, even though I don't like the readings every day, at least it's just something different to read out of. And it usually has, you know, people thinking about stuff, and some readings are good and some readings are bad, but, you know, whatever. And we use that. So then, as I said, the pandemic hit. We started a new meeting on Saturdays in Paris, and it's still going. It's at 12 o'clock, and it's on the paris.org website, aaparis.org, if you guys are interested. And that's a really good meeting at 12 o'clock noon Paris time. It's a lot of British people come to that. What else can I say? I've gone on already. It's like over 30 minutes, and I start running out of things to say. But I have a good life because I don't drink and do drugs. If I had started drinking or using drugs, then I wouldn't have the good life I had. And, you know, if there's, I actually, oh yeah, I was writing down things. I wrote down 12 things, only maybe I didn't get all the way to 12. 12 things I learned in AA. I was also going to set up my computer, and then I realized it was already almost 7 o'clock. So I'm on my phone still. 12 things I learned in AA. The first thing about AA is that, and you notice I picked the number 12, you know, so it's because it's a magic number in AA. The first thing is, you know, I just, and this is the whole premise of AA is that, you know, I cannot drink normally. And if I pick up a drink, it's going to be, if I do pick up a drink, it would be catastrophic. Because you hang around like me 35 fucking years in AA, and you see, I really think in many ways I've learned more from the people who have slipped, who have continued to slip, who have died, who have, you know, and I think of this guy. There was like a beautiful guy who was coming to Paris. He was so good looking. And I was like, and he was so nice. And he was a pastry chef. And he had a slip and came back, and he, you know, like fell out of a window and came. He was in a body cast and a neck brace. And I thought, fuck, you know, that's exactly what would happen to me if I picked up a kid. You know, I just go completely fucking nuts. So that's the number one thing, is like not to pick up a drink, you know. And you know, life without a drink, it's good, but it can also be bad. It can be horrible. It can be like, you know, shit does happen. This is number two. But it's still life, you know. It's still reality. And if there's anything that I've learned, is that I cannot escape reality. I mean, okay, momentarily, yes. But, you know, alcohol and drugs, reality will always came back and will always come back to slap me in the face. You know, it's just cannot be escaped. So, yeah, that was two. Three. I can't even read my own writing now. I had to go to the eye doctor today, and because I had something wrong with my eye, and it was horrible. But anyway, so much for the public health system here. Well, I guess it was something about one day at a time, and it, to try and stay in the present, stay in the day. That's what helps me But of course I can't always do that, you know, but not getting super obsessed with what could happen, what can happen, what might happen. You know, I have to like try and be and live in the present. It's just like, that's a helpful thing that I think eliminates somewhere. Number four is avoid AA gurus. You know, those people, and I think that's also why I have to go back. For me, I have to avoid a traditional AA, because the gurus are there. They know the right way, and it's the steps, and you have to work the steps in order. And, you know, if you don't, you're going to be on a dry drunk. And it's all these things that we hear in regular AA, which I don't really think those things are that fucking true. I don't really believe in a dry drunk. I get into bad moods, but, you know, so does everybody. You know, I don't believe that unless I pick up a drink or a drug. I don't, you know, a dry drunk for me, just, okay, I understand the expression, but I don't believe in that stuff. And I don't believe that there's one particular portion of sobriety or whatever you want to call it that is more important than others. I do not believe that 12 steps are the answer to my life, no more than I believe that there is one God, no more than I believe. I was in Turin this week, and great employee, this guy works on my team. He took us around Turin and showed us everything. And of course, we have to make the obligatory stop at the church where the Shroud of Turin is. Of course, they don't have it on exposed. They have like only life, whatever size, big pictures of it and stuff in this church and everything. And the guy was going on about, yes, and, you know, they haven't been able to disprove it or prove it, whatever. And then he's going, well, you know, but we know that, you know, from this, from the accounts of Jesus' life, that the image on here really looks like what Jesus looked like. And I was like, wait a fucking minute, you know, John Maria, quit giving us this crap. You know, I just couldn't take it anymore. No, there's no physical description of Jesus. We don't know if he exists. And he got really pissed off, but, you know, I couldn't help it. So I don't know why I digressed to that, but that was my week in touring. Okay, but avoid AA gurus and avoid those people in traditional AA. That's my solution. Number five of my things learned AA is work out a lot, get a lot of exercise. You know, do what I have to do, whatever I can, to stay in good condition. What AA says, you have to stay in good spiritual condition. Just take out for me the word spiritual, and I have to try and stay in good condition. And I'm like going on like really a lot tonight. So I don't know, but I should stop soon. But anyway, work out a lot. One I'm already mentioned is about, you know, taking the coffee pot and the resentment and start another meeting. Zoom has been so fantastic. I've seen and met so many fantastic people in these Zoom meetings, and it's just like a whole new thing. However, I can't have that be an exclusive way. And that's why I was really glad to go back to a face-to-face meeting. We had face-to-face meetings in Italy and here in Paris this week for work. And it's, you know, the virtual connection, whatever we're calling it, is good, but it's still not as good as meeting people face-to-face and having coffee. And there's just a whole that's important. So I'll continue to do the Zoom meetings, that's for sure. But I also want to continue to go to when I find good meetings. The other thing I learned, I don't know if I learned this from AA or maybe my mom used to always say this, which is familiarity breeds contempt. You know, and I really believe that, because I've gotten in so many arguments with people in AA, and so much stuff has happened, but I just got to remember that. I mean, that's some ways the Zoom meetings are better, because you don't become so familiar with the people. I mean, there's been some trouble in some of the Zoom meetings anyway, you know, but not as much, because you don't, I mean, the connection is, it's somehow less intense, and you can just, if you don't like somebody, you can just kind of turn them off or turn off the camera or whatever. So, but realizing that, you know, I want to have good relationships with other people, and to repair relationships, sometimes I have to be less harsh, less outspoken, less me, you know, and just like, okay, you know, I could say accept, which is a really big AA word, accept other people the way they are. And I'm not very good about doing that, you know. Another thing I have on the list is that that restraint is good, and I'm not the most restrained person, but sometimes it can just be way better not to say anything. You know, I have learned that in life, and maybe in AA, and of course the AA expression is restraint of tongue and pen. You know, yeah, I've regretted. You know, I got into big arguments with a woman who I sponsored about, you know, she did a really nasty thing to somebody else, and it just got too involved and too, you know, and I should have been a little more restrained. And this past year, I really let somebody else just have it, you know, and I could have been a little less restrained. So that's, you know, I learn these things and I forget them and I think, oh yeah, well, I should have done better. And this is almost the last one. Alcohol was my problem. Okay. I do not believe this when people say alcohol was a symptom of my problem. Alcohol and drugs were my problem. Of course I have other problems. Of course, you know, there's other stuff going on, but you know, until, and this therapist told me that back in 1981, he's like, you know, until you have a lot of problems, because that was what I was telling him. I was telling him, you know, I'm drinking because I have this problem and I don't know what it is, or I don't know what I told the guy. It was obviously just a fucking excuse. But I, you know, and he's like, well, yes, you have a lot of problems, but you can't solve any of your other problems as long as you're drinking and using drugs. So for me, the biggest problems I ever had in my life were alcohol and drugs. And if I don't use those things, I can work on my other problems. Oh, yeah. I also like to turn around one of the AA slogans, which is, so what I like to say is I have to follow personalities over principles. It's the personalities here who have helped me. It's the personalities, the people I talk to, the people I like, the people I can get along with, maybe even some of the ones that I haven't liked, who have taught me stuff. I don't really have that many principles. Sorry. And maybe I do have some principles, but you know, it's like, I can't go to AA meetings where people are, you know, giving me a load of shit about higher power and this step. And I just, you know, I'm not hearing that. I am not having it anymore. But it's meetings like this. And like, I love the thing you guys said, you know, we don't have a timer. It goes on a while, you know, and I've seen like in regular AA, they use that timer thing. It's just like, they use the timer thing. They use the thing like, what's the other one we talked about it today in another meeting I went to was outside issues. Oh, you shouldn't talk about outside issues. And I've seen so many people shut down, whether they talked about Trump or whether they talk about drugs or whether they talk about whatever it is. And I've been to several regular meetings where they just shut the person down. It's like, that's an outside issue. You can't talk about that. Drugs. That's an outside issue. You shouldn't talk about drugs. Well, you know, fuck you, man. I mean, I just, there aren't outside issues, are there? I mean, really? Is it if I'm here and whatever affects me as a person in recovery, if I really feel like, you know, I should, whatever you say in 5 minutes, as long as I don't, or the only time I've ever shut people down anyway is when they become really aggressive towards somebody else in the meeting, and that happens. It's only happened in the whole Zoom time. It happened once, maybe twice, where I had to like cut somebody off, you know. So I try not to do that. And I've talked way too long, you know. So I talked over 40 minutes, and that's definitely enough out of me. I hope you guys stay sober. Don't pick up the first drink, no matter what happens. And life, if it's not good now, it'll get better. It'll also get worse. Then it'll get better again. So. That's That's AA and Sober Life, according to John tonight. So thanks for asking me to speak, and thanks for listening all this time.